Welcome to the latest episode of The Grower and the Economist. I'm Michelle Klieger, the Economist.
And I'm Peter Kanjoyan, the Grower.
Each week, we team up to tackle the biggest challenges facing small and medium-sized growers. We're one part grower and one part economist, just like your business.
Well, on today's episode of The Gate, we're fortunate to have a colleague of mine join us, Dr. Andrew Ogden at the University of New Hampshire, has recently completed his doctoral program at UNH, has been teaching at the undergraduate level for a number of years. Andrew, thanks for joining us and welcome to The Gate. Would you take a minute or two and share with our listeners your career path?
Be happy to, and thanks for having me on today. So I've been working as a lecturer, now a senior lecturer for the past 4 years, started out as a lecturer 9 years ago at the University of New Hampshire, teaching courses for our sustainable agriculture and food systems major. So I teach a lot of the horticulture-related courses, some hands-on courses in food production, quite a number of different courses. Moved here actually from Costa Rica. I run and own a small farm in Costa Rica down on the Pacific side near the town of Uvita in the southern Pacific coast. And prior to that, I had gotten my master's degree at the University of Georgia. That was in horticulture, and that was following about 7 or 8 years of life experience, working on farms, doing a lot of different things. Actually got my undergraduate degree from UNC Chapel Hill. That was in anthropology and environmental studies back in 1998. And I was really interested in the environment. My interest came initially in trying to see how we could be a little better on the environment in our world in general, and then sort of zeroed in on food production as an area that seemed like needed a lot of improvements. I didn't come from an agricultural background at all, so I really didn't get exposed to horticulture and agriculture until I was an undergraduate at UNC Chapel Hill.
Well, thank you. And you're looking for your next assignment, your next appointment. Is that correct?
I'm continuing in my role as a senior lecturer currently, while at the same time hoping to get into a position that would enable me to keep going with my research and some of the plant breeding work that I started during my doctorate.
Excellent. And we're going to get to your research in a moment. The first point I wanted to bring up is your background, having worked on farms internationally and domestically, Andrew, I think you may agree have helped mold you and helped you design your PhD project, your graduate work along the way. And you and I share that background where we've had farming in our lives prior to our graduate careers. And just speak a moment to that point, how understanding a commercial operation may have worked into or helped you design your research program.
Sure. I started working in the realm of organic agriculture, and mostly in vegetable production, working on a small farm in the North Carolina mountains that's still actually running today called Green Toe Ground, a pretty successful small vegetable organic operation. That was around 1999, 2000. Organic was still kind of on the periphery of society, I would say. It certainly hadn't gone mainstream. And I felt like, hey, there were a lot of practices that maybe hadn't had a lot of research done on them, fair amount of anecdotal information, but you know, certainly not a lot of scientific research in that realm of organic horticulture. And so after working in the field for some years, I started taking an interest in, hey, maybe there are ways that some of these practices could be improved and might benefit from some more dedicated research. So that helped me to get interested. And then my research that I've done for my master's, for instance, at University of Georgia, was with an organic crop. We We grew blueberries organically and raised beds of pine bark media, and we grew them inside of high tunnels with the goal of trying to get early berries. And a lot of these fruits and vegetables, a few weeks or a month earliness or even late, just getting things to come in out of season can make that production a lot more profitable. So we sought to advance flowering in blueberries using high tunnels, and it was an organic crop, so it would be sort of high value. And that was with my master's, and then in my PhD, certainly my awareness that dealing with plant pathogens as a major problem in organics. And so for part of my PhD, I tackled some powdery mildew resistance in squash and pumpkin, because that's one of our top diseases in this area. So certainly my experiences in farms have helped inform some of my research ideas.
Excellent. Michelle, there's the international layer that you and Andrew share, and Andrew and I also share part of our UNH experience. Andrew's PhD advisor, who unfortunately passed away a little over a year ago, was my undergraduate advisor when I was an undergrad at UNH in the mid-70s. And chances are, any of our listeners who are small farmers who may grow squash or pumpkins, chances are they've grown something that was bred by Brent Loy. Spend a minute and perhaps talk about if you know a few of the commercial cultivars that came out of Brent's program at UNH that are fairly common.
Sure. You know, Dr. Brent Loy was an incredibly prolific breeder. You know, he's got upwards of 90 different varieties out released across, from pumpkins to squash to melons. There's the variety Halona. There's a bunch of melons, Sugar Cube, Sugar Rush, Diplomat, and Passport. Those are some Gallia-style melons. He's got a ton of ornamental pumpkins across all the different colors, from orange pumpkins to white pumpkins to yellow pumpkins. He bred a lot of different small gourds, even like the little egg gourds that look like an egg, but have different coloring patterns. He bred the whole series of summer squash cultivars that are under the name of Slick Pick. Was a patent that they originally came out as patented varieties that he bred to. They don't have any of those sharp trichomes or spines on the leaves and the leaf stems, so they're much easier to pick and far better on the health of the people picking them, as far as getting the rashes on your arms after picking squash for a whole day. Bred a couple of really delicious acorn squash. There's a honey bear. Sugar bush is a variety that's out through High Mowing Organic Seeds. Worked with a lot of different seed companies, and he liked working with some of the smaller companies. So he did quite a bit of work with High Mowing, also Seneca Valley Research. He has a bunch of varieties out with Johnny's Selected Seeds. He and Rob Johnson were quite good friends and collaborated on a lot of Johnny's varieties.
That's so cool.
So I'm going to jump in, and I actually came across Dr. Lloyd's work last year. I was working on, can we diversify some of the row crop production in the upper Mississippi? And one of the ideas that we came up with was pumpkins, like pumpkin seeds, because when you grow the pumpkins for edible seeds, it becomes much more of an industrial operation instead of, you know, needing that perfect fruit. And he has one of the Hollis varieties that would be very important in this. And the challenge with pumpkins, growing pumpkin seeds in the United States, is that China is a huge producer, and when threatened, are able to flood the market. And even a competitive grower in the United States, it is very difficult to withstand that pressure since their production in China is so much higher. So it's kind of interesting when you need all of these pieces, right? You need someone breeding this variety that grows well and fits the profile of the grower and the consumer. But then there's also this international piece at play on how do you, where do you fit in the market? Like, yes, this is a good opportunity. It's a low manual labor. So it's something that we could do quite affordably in the United States, but we are a small fish in this game. So,
oh, that is interesting. Yeah, those Hollis seeded pumpkins, I mean, they're delicious. I think they should be a much bigger snack item than they are. And one, Brent did succeed the last couple of years of his life. He actually did get connected up with a grower in the Midwest. I think it's either Ohio or Illinois, with a real interest in producing those pumpkins. And he was had already had quite a large operation and has started a snack seed line. He actually sent a whole bunch of boxes of his new products out to Brent's funeral last summer. They were giving those out, and it was nice. Brent worked really hard trying to kind of get more people aware of those as snacks, and maybe for some of the reasons you mentioned, international factors, it didn't seem to take off as much as we all thought it really had potential to.
I'm thinking he was probably just a few years ahead of his time. And as a plant breeder, you have to be, right? I'm sure he worked on those varieties for at least a decade. But with so much interest in alternative proteins and plant-based diets, all of the edible seed categories, whether it's all of the edible seed categories are really taking off. And so in 2020, I did work on edible pumpkin seeds. I found out that people eat edible watermelon seeds and they're really good for your hair. And then Ocean Spray brought out an edible cranberry seed. So that market is just really exploding. And maybe the ability to grow helped cause that, or it's just he was just a few years ahead of where consumer demand is now really asking for these products.
He was known to be ahead of his time. I know he got a lot of those. He saw it was in Eastern Europe where they were growing those types, like Lady Godiva, where they produce them more for oil, like for oil extraction. But those were some of the ones that he started out with in his breeding, and through selecting for large seed size and large seed yield, something like one of the last ones he got out was called Naked Bear, and it's a small pumpkin with a large seed cavity, just absolutely stuffed full of seeds.
And how many years ago? Not that many. Up to that point, Andrew, that was discarded. You know, that was the last thing that we were selecting for in a fruit, right? Is a lot of seeds.
Well, that's the thing. There's in these different types, we might be selecting for a lot of seeds, but not necessarily. And so in this particular crop, you know, he was doing selection and selecting each year the large seeds and the ones with high numbers of seeds. And he really, I remember he was saying he boosted the harvest, kind of harvest index. It is a value around the number of seeds produced per amount of fruit, the total fruit weight. He was impressed and surprised at how much he got that to climb over the years. Probably, I'm sure he spent at least 15 years on those varieties.
And you know, on this topic of breeding, guys, In my more recent work with Controlled Environment Ag, and Andrew, you've given me the opportunity to guest lecture in some of your production classes at UNH that I appreciate greatly. My comments have been that we need to breed for high density production in a controlled environment. And the more I think about it, the more I think that these cultivars may already be have been made, these crosses may have been made, but discarded because for field production, we don't want small and compact heads of lettuce. We want larger heads of lettuce. So I'm sure somewhere along the way, what's old is new again. And you know, this whole cycle of beauty in the eye of the beholder, et cetera. The other point, Michelle, two episodes ago, you and I talked about high tunnels and shoulder seasons, getting the early crop versus in the late crop. Andrew, we talked about tomatoes and how the first tomatoes coming from the field sold for the highest price. And it's really cool to see you connect that through your reporting of your master's research with blueberries and high tunnels. And he said exactly what we were talking about, Michelle, right, with the early season and then the late season extension. So thanks for reinforcing a principle that she and I have been talking about on a recurring basis. So now let's shift into I once had one of my graduate advisory members told me as I was approaching the end of my doctoral work that at this point in your life, you probably know more than you're ever going to know at one point about plants and plant physiology and all. And I've shared that with you over the course of this last year. So you're coming out of this period of time. You've concentrated on plant breeding. Now take a few minutes, talk to us about what you chose as a PhD research project.
When I arrived at UNH, Dr. Loy, he had taught a couple of the existing vegetable courses that we had. And so he was, I got to meet him right away, and he was very gracious with sharing those teaching materials with me. And I think I'd only been here about a week, and he said, "So, Andrew, are you going to do a PhD here or what?" And I really hadn't thought about it yet. I was getting ready to teach a whole bunch of new courses and wasn't ready for it at that point. Then a few years went by, and our Brent and my friendship continued to grow, and co-advised a couple of projects for students who were looking for a research project. As a lecturer, we don't have research programs, so to speak. So I was kind of channeling some students over to Dr. Loy. And the interest really came about through one of those students, a student who we ended up sending to Costa Rica to collect some cucurbit germplasm and work with a Costa Rican professor for a summer. She received a scholarship through our International Research Opportunities Program that we have here at UNH. And so that further solidified Brent and I kind of working together on cucurbits. And I had experience growing some tropical pumpkin, which is the same species actually as butternut squash. I had grown that some in Costa Rica and had talked with Brent about my experience doing that. And we started brainstorming about a few different ideas, mostly around this idea that, hey, sometimes you need to use germplasm that's from areas outside of your region, and that can present challenges in terms of making crosses and flowering times. There's occasions where he's wanted to use something for a cross and for breeding, but maybe that is a wild species and it takes far too long to flower to coincide with the domesticated flowering patterns. So he had sort of a broad question around, hey, how can we figure out ways to better utilize exotic germplasm? How can we use it better in a breeding program? And so I had three chapters, and one of the chapters dealt with, one of the main problems is in cucurbits, there's not much published on any genes regulating flowering time. It's it's kind of an unknown area. So we had one, the first chapter was really an inheritance study. Dr. Loy had identified within some of his acorn squash breeding material, two breeding lines with very different distinct flowering times. So he had a really early line and a very late line. And so we created breeding populations, F2 and back cross populations to try to do a little inheritance study of this, what we ended up naming as an early flowering gene, named EF, appears to be dominant to incompletely dominant to late flowering. And it's a mutation that turned up in some of his breeding lines. So we got that out there. And that gene could be useful for, say, breeding acorns that finish up and mature early in the season. So you could, get them out of the field before perhaps some disease pressure even arrives. We also hope to transfer the gene into pumpkin across the subspecies where it could promote early flowering and some pumpkin lines that can be very late flowering. So that was kind of the first chapter. In the second chapter, we worked on a grafting methodology to try to force these, say, late flowering cultigens or short day flowering cultigens into flowering under our day length, under the long days of summer. And so we developed a grafting technique that had some success in promoting flowering of some types that just normally under our summer day lengths would just extend and extend vegetatively, but not produce any flowers. And so we worked on trying out different rootstocks, trying different stages of grafting. And we did have some success in using a day neutral early flowering rootstock to trigger the flowering of a short day or just very late flowering scion. So we showed some potential there for use of grafting for that purpose. Mostly it would be for breeding purposes or trying to, say, produce seed of something that is generally really hard to get to flower and produce seed under our day length.
On this topic of grafting, because we're seeing it popping up in other edible crops, tomato comes to mind. Can you tell us or compare tomato to cucurbits in terms of why are we grafting tomatoes? Is it for similar reasons that you're describing with cucurbits?
Yes and no. Grafting these cucurbits in our case was kind of unique in trying to promote them to flower, to promote exotic types to flower here. But there is commercial grafting of cucurbits going on that I would say the goals of that are similar to what you're seeing in tomato, where you're using a rootstock, really good disease resistance with good vigor, tolerance of even, say, in some cases, maybe salinity tolerance or low temperature tolerance. Having that in your rootstock and then your scion, the upper portion is always going to be your desired cultivar, the fruit that you want to have. And so with tomatoes, growers are having success with taking things like heirloom varieties that have beautiful fruits and really great flavor, but may be susceptible to some soil-borne pathogens. And so could you take that heirloom and graft it onto a rootstock that's resistant to soil diseases, and then you've got perhaps the best of both worlds, a hardy root system, resistant to diseases, but then the scion is your desired cultivar.
And isn't this really common in cucurbit? Specifically, I'm thinking watermelon. Aren't most of them transplants now?
Transplants or grafted. I'm not sure what percentage of watermelons are grafted now, but it's growing. I don't think it's, at least in the U.S., I don't think it's a majority. all these practices in cucurbits, you know, that really came out of Asia, Japan and Korea, not being able to really rotate crops effectively. And so needing to, it was mostly in cucumber. They had buildup of fusarium and soils and started realizing they could graft those onto something resistant and keep growing it in that soil despite the presence of the pathogen. Very common in Asia, growing in Europe as well. Italy has quite a lot of grafted production to where they have, you know, specialized nurseries and even robotic grafters. And cantaloupe melons benefit from grafting. There's some grafted melon production I know out in the Southwest. And we showed, Dr. Loy actually developed, he has some rootstocks developed. He didn't quite get them released. They're in progress that are, it's an interspecific hybrid of Cucurbita maxima times Cucurbita machata as your rootstock, and then you put a melon on there. And for our region, where it's, you know, we're a little bit cool for optimal melon production, we get really big yield increases if we use this rootstock.
Cool. Michelle, let's tie that into our earlier conversation about the home garden. And you may remember me saying when you and I were talking about crops that you had an interest in growing, whenever a home gardener, and this is hearkening my garden center days, Andrew, when a home gardener would come and say, I'd like to plant watermelon and cantaloupe and pumpkins, my question then would be, well, how much space do you have? Because you're making a full season commitment. And oh, by the way, with melons and cantaloupes, by the time they ripen in New England, the hot part of the summer's gone and you almost don't feel like eating them. You have to wait so long for them to ripen. So what you're saying or describing could be a boon for New England gardeners, where we may actually get a ripe melon in August before Labor Day.
It has a lot of promise, and probably for the home gardener would be very suitable. You know, for commercial production, it's still in the research stages in terms of the costs, you know, associated with, now each plant has two seeds in it and it has some extra labor. Grafting does take an extra step, and then the plants have to go through about a 9-day healing process. In the areas of the world where it's really become prominent, I think it's become cost effective. Here, we're still in sort of an early stage. But we did have one local farm this year here in Lee, Doobie Doo Farm. I helped them to graft the melons, and they grew them in a high tunnel and trained them to grow up vertically. They were quite pleased. They were hoping out of their 30 by 96 tunnel, they were hoping to pull around 2,000 pounds of melons out of there. For them, in this area, they're new farmers, and they were some of your more traditional vegetables, the market's getting a little saturated. And they zeroed in on melons as something that not as many of the growers around here have. And they kind of carved out a little market for those as being something not as common.
Tying a little bit back to the CEA discussion, when you introduced your work, you said that you were doing some on cucurbits and powdery mildew. And that feels like one of the places where there are everything that's grown in the field needs to be thinking about that powdery mildew and how resistant it is. And if you have less of those concerns indoor, some of the varieties that you've researched or discarded because they can't stand up to the powdery mildew in the field might suddenly work well inside when we get there. And so I think it's kind of interesting that some of the biggest field challenges are going to be different, and like that lens that you show up breeding for indoor is going to be very different than even what you spent so much of your time focusing on in your research.
Yeah, you certainly can get powdery in high tunnels too. It can be a real issue even in a controlled environment. So having stuff with resistance should be helpful in that environment as well.
And then, Andrew, I interrupted as you were shifting from chapter 2 to chapter 3. So Finish off with chapter 3, and then let's have some fun talking about the international scene before we let you go.
So the third chapter was on the topic that Michelle just mentioned, the powdery mildew resistance.
Got there too early.
The third chapter was dealing with powdery mildew resistance, and although we were looking at a few different sources of resistance, the one that we developed the most and did the most research on, I only included one in my dissertation, and that was that Dr. Loy identified this line of Cucurbita machata, but it was a round fruited type that he had acquired from hybrid seeds in New Zealand many years ago. And he just started noticing in his fields each year that it seemed to really hold up well to powdery mildew. Here, the powdery mildew arrives every year around the first week of August, travels actually up in the clouds. The little spores travel from where it gets established in the southeast first, comes up and works its way north. So it arrives in New Hampshire every August. And he just noted that, hey, this particular line always holds up well and it doesn't get much powdery mildew. And so we created the necessary crosses, you know, taking that and crossing it with something susceptible. In our case, we used Waltham butternut, which is really kind of an industry standard, good fruit quality, you know, grown all around the world, but fully susceptible to powdery mildew. So that was our kind of susceptible control. And so we created F2 and back cross populations and determined that this line has a single gene. It's going to end up being PM1. Get this published. It'll be PM1. It's a new gene that provides, it's an intermediate level of resistance. It's not absolute resistance in Cucurbita in the sense where you can completely eliminate the disease. We're always dealing with some level of infection. But we've got a new source and we're working on establishing that. We're using the back cross system to stabilize this new gene into a good butternut background, and actually have developed a molecular marker for it to help us with the breeding process, trying to get it into now other types of squash and pumpkin.
Andrew, it's not often that a PhD project will result in this level of significance of contribution. So I'm sure you're proud of the work that you're able to do with Brent and identifying a gene and naming a gene. That's a big deal. So congratulations on that.
Well, thank you. Ultimately, the neater part of that beyond naming the gene would be that if we could get it into some commercial cultivars and that could result in growers having to use less fungicide, then we've got an environmental benefit and maybe an economic benefit if that, you know, one other input costs come down. And that's, to me, what would be ultimately most satisfying.
That's what I love hearing that, Andrew. Michelle's heard me say many, many times that if in horticulture you're not interested in the grower first and foremost, if you're not interested in helping the grower, then please move to botany. So thanks for kind of course correcting. So why don't you end up just a few minutes? We've taken, talk to us a little bit about the farm in Costa Rica. I know you've told me that during your teaching days prior to COVID, you would take small groups down to your farm. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Way back in 2002, I had two good college friends, and we kind of had a dream to try to start a farm and educational center together. And in 2002, we purchased together this tract of land in Uvita, and slowly been developing it. It was really raw land, no infrastructure, no water, no electricity. We were able to get basic infrastructure established, cabins. We put in a gravity-powered water system, raised bed gardens, established a lot of different fruit trees. Right now, it's kind of, there's some local folks who help us keep it up and local family who's living there currently and enjoying some of the produce from it. And we get down there. Typically, most Januarys, I'm there with my group of students. So I have a course here at UNH called Agriculture and Development in the Neotropics. And we spend 3 weeks traveling around Costa Rica. We visit my farm for just about 3 to 4 days. The rest of the time, we're traveling all around the country. I try to show them tropical agriculture at a lot of different scales. So from kind of home gardening, subsistence kind of farming, which is really all we're really doing at our farm currently, up to medium-sized operations in coffee and cacao, up to really the really large operations of pineapple and banana, and showing the students those all the complex networks and stuff in place for those global industries. And I've also started doing some work in Peru. In the last few years, we had a university from down there approach us actually with an interest in high tunnels. They were looking at a grant program that was aimed at promoting new relationships between Latin American universities and American ones. And we have this nice relationship now with a university in northern Peru. And one of their professors was looking at UNH's knowledge and skills in this arena of high tunnels. And he thought, hey, this could be really helpful for some of our sites in Peru. And so they came up. They sent a group of students and faculty member here, toured them around. They learned about high tunnels. They went back to Peru, actually constructed a tunnel down there. And then I took a group of students to Peru as the kind of second half of that exchange. And so that's kind of a newer relationship. I don't have a formal course yet to go down there, but they have, of course, tons of agrobiodiversity and tons of stuff of interest for our students.
That must be amazing. That sounds really exciting. We often talk about the bigger programs here domestically. It's nice to give some airtime to a small university like UNH, and contributions can be made regardless of the size of the school.
I could add one thing, just kind of piggybacking on Michelle's comments around China and the economy. That is such an important point, and that economics part is so important. Dr. Loy ran into this with his acorn squash breeding, where he bred varieties of acorn squash that taste far better than what you typically see in grocery stores. But there is no variety differentiation yet amongst acorn squash. And so getting people on board with growing these improved varieties is hard, because your fresh weight yield may actually go down a little bit if you start having more starch and more sugars in your fruit. The grower may actually yield a little bit less in terms of fresh weight. If they're being sold by the pound, the growers are being paid by the pound, and to the grower, they're not going to get any more for a higher quality fruit than they would for the standard varieties. Most of your acorn squash cultivars in the market have this L2 gene, dominant gene, that makes them turn dark brown, dark black almost, quite early, maybe by 30 days in their development. We know they don't actually hit peak quality until about 50 days. If you've got a field full of these things and they look ready and nobody's checking the quality of them, then why not just harvest them early? Who cares what the fruit quality is? Some of that gets into your areas of economics, and yeah, you've got a superior product, but if there's not a way for the consumer to know that it's superior, then it just kind of gets lost in the marketplace. And that's why some of those types have not yet made it into the mainstream markets.
You guys have both made excellent points on that. Michelle, several episodes ago, didn't we have Dr. Bridget Behe from Michigan State on, a marketing researcher, Andrew, in horticulture? And the title of that episode is something like, "It's Our Game to Lose." And what Andrew's describing is that short-sightedness that some growers might have, Michelle, to just crank it out and ship it out. But in the long run, we might be hurting ourselves. My final comment, Andrew, is going to fold into what you just described with the squashes. And Michelle's heard me say repeatedly, why shouldn't we be paying a little more for our food, eating higher quality food, and less of the non-nutritious part of food? So, you know, you're telling us that Brent bred quality into acorn squash, but we've not listened to the Dr. Behe's of the world explaining to us how we're supposed to market them so that the economists of the world, like Michelle, can then put it all together for us and help guide these small farmers along. Okay, that's it for me. I want to thank you, Andrew, for taking time. Give you an
pleasure. I enjoyed speaking with both of you very much, and thanks for having me on. And